Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Hello everyone. You listen to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 15th of June. We will continue listen to Master Tenzin Chosen's program with the book Mind Training Like the Rays of Sun and by Lam Kapow. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program today. I hope your week has gone well and you're in good heart. We've been considering Lam Kapow's text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, and last week we came to the end of the introduction in which the author discusses what we need to do to make it a success of each meditation session. First, he says, we need to create a nice environment. For example, setting up some beautiful pictures and flower arrangements and so on, and creating an altar with representations of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. He then mentions reciting various prayers and offering a mandala, a representation of the world system. Tibetan Buddhism has a strongly ritualized procedure for this, but you could just visualize the whole universe and everything in it and offer that. Try to remember that none of it has independent existence, including yourself. The text then goes on to mention doing various prayers and activities before going on to describe the actual meditation session itself. First, we should remember how our mind stream, which has no beginning, has always been under the control of disturbing emotions. Unless we do something about curbing these disturbing forces, they will continue to plague us far into the future and cause unending suffering. So, Lam Kapow says, we have to take control of our mind so that it doesn't venture where it has no right being and will stay comfortably where we put it for as long as we want it to be there. To acquire such a mind, he writes, it is necessary to focus on the specific subject of meditation without being distracted by laxity or excitement. These meditations should follow the given order, and except for the training and the perfection of concentration, they are all analytical meditations. Last week, we went into some of the benefits of developing our mind in this way, focusing on developing compassion, and looking at the current research, found that such meditation has a great many benefits, more, I suspect, than most of us imagined. The third and last recommendation that Lam Kapow makes before going into the preliminary meditations is that we recite preparatory prayers and practices, so preparing our mind for the meditations to come. He writes, thirdly, in conclusion, we should make perfect prayers, such as the prayer of good conduct and so forth. We should practice this way 3 times during the day and 3 times during the night. During meditation sessions, the senses should be controlled, mental alertness and introspection maintained, and a balanced diet observed. Effort should be made to become an unsleeping yogi, and you should know how to use the period of sleep to develop calm abiding and special insight, as taught by the exalted Asanga. Well now, this last instruction is in all likelihood beyond most of us, so we won't go into it. But of course, if you were a long-term meditator in solitary retreat, without anything on your day apart from practice, you may well find how to develop the power to become an unsleeping yogi. Lam Kapow then goes into the first of the preliminary meditations, which is life as a free and fortunate human being. But now before we go into that, let's set our motivation as usual. And as usual, try to make that motivation bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Or at least, may this program be the cause for your own liberation from all dissatisfaction and suffering. Now let's try and set a motivation. Thank you. The nature of life as a free and fortunate human being is freedom from the 8 states without leisure and possession of the 10 beneficial circumstances, writes Nam Kao Pal. And then goes on, the 8 states are given in the friendly letter. And this refers to Letter to a Friend, in which the great Indian master Nagarjuna gives advice to his friend, the king Gautama Maputra Satakani. The verses Nam Kao Pal referred to go, being born as one holding wrong views, as an animal, a hungry ghost or a hell being, in a place where the Buddha's word does not prevail, as a barbarian in remote regions, stupid and dumb, or as a long-lived god, are the 8 states without leisure. Having found the opportunity of freedom from them, exert yourself to turn away birth. Now, 4 of these states relate to non-human life and 4 to human life. Being born as an animal, hungry ghost or hell being, or as a long-lived god, refer to non-human life, while the other 4 refer to the conditions we can find ourselves while having a human rebirth. For those unfamiliar with the 4 non-human states mentioned here, there are hell being, hungry ghost, animal, and long-lived god. Life as a hell being is obvious. One is born in a state of extreme suffering and torture. Various descriptions of hell experiences are given in the Buddhist literature, and they're pretty gruesome. But the point here is that if we happen to find ourselves in such a state due to our karma, it will be impossible to practice the Dharma. All that we will be concerned with will be the suffering we're going through, and we'll be unable to think of anything outside of that. Well, imagine trying to practice the Dharma in a situation as described by a 376-page UN report on the concentration camps inside North Korea. The report contains testimonies of people who were imprisoned in the camps, but when released later, escaped to outside countries. It states, in the political prison camps of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the inmate population has been gradually eliminated through deliberate starvation, forced labor, executions, torture, rape, and forced abortion and infanticide. One of the escapees was Kim Hyuk, who was orphaned at the age of 12 and later imprisoned for smuggling rice from China. In an article from the Mail Online, Kim Hyuk says, I knew I had to survive on my own, so I would eat anything. And I ate lizards, snakes, rats, reptiles, whatever. Reptiles were the only meat I could eat. In the springtime, I would eat grass. But if you ate the wrong grass, then you would get poisoned and you would suffer swelling and bloating. I would eat different types of grass and roots. In the camps, torture is ongoing. The Mail Online article notes, the UN panel heard from one anonymous witness who described how she was forced to stand on tiptoes in a tank of cold water. If she lowered her heels by even a fraction of an inch, her nostrils would be underwater and she would drown. A former state security official recalled how prisoners would be crammed into small metal cages for hours so that the circulation in their extremities would be cut off and their limbs would swell and turn brown. Jung Kwang-il, who was imprisoned in Camp 15 for trading with South Koreans, said, there were so many different tortures. The most difficult was the pigeon torture, which I was subjected to for 10 months. You are handcuffed behind your back, and then they hang you so that you're not able to stand or sit, and you would look like a pigeon with their chest pushed out. Then they would beat you with clubs. They would beat you, kick you on the thighs. You can't stand, you can't sleep, and you're hanged like this for 3-4 days. You urinate, you defecate, you're totally dehydrated. It was so painful that I felt it was better to die. Now, the hells of the Buddhist literature are even more severe than these descriptions, but imagine even trying to practice the Dharma in a North Korean camp. I would say it'd be nearly impossible, don't you think? Of course, some of the Tibetans who experienced much the same sort of treatment in Chinese communist prisons did use their prison time to practice, even under such difficult conditions. But if it had been me, I really doubt I could have done it. Another of the favorable conditions for being able to practice the Dharma is not being born as a hungry ghost. Now, life as a hungry ghost is the life of a creature never satisfied, but always hungry for something. In Buddhism, hungry ghosts are characterized as always starving, but hardly ever finding anything to eat. They have huge bellies, but tiny mouths and long, thin necks, through which it is difficult for anything to pass. Even if a hungry ghost finds something to eat, swallowing it often causes great suffering. In his book, In the Realm of the Hungry Ghosts, Dr. Gabor Mate describes the hungry ghost mentality in the human realm. They live, he writes, in the domain of addictions, where we constantly seek something outside ourselves to curb the insatiable yearning for relief or fulfillment. The aching emptiness is perpetual because the substances, objects, or pursuits we hope will soothe it are not what we really need. We don't know what we need, and so long as we stay in the hungry ghost realm, we will never know. We haunt our lives without being fully present. He goes on, I believe there is one addiction process, whether it is manifested in the lethal substance dependencies of my downtown East Side patients, the frantic self-soothing of overeaters or shopaholics, the obsessions of gamblers, sexaholics, and compulsive internet users, or the socially acceptable and even admired behaviors of the workaholic. People can even use a spiritual path as an addictive dependency, and then it has no spirituality in it at all. This all describes the psychology of the hungry ghost, if not the physical manifestation given in the Buddhist literature. But again, the point is that as long as we have this type of mentality, we cannot seriously practice the Dharma, and in particular, for our purposes, the mind training teachings. The next state we are free from is the animal realm, which we all know about, and the impossibility of Dharma practice for those who inhabit it. Over the years in the Dharma centers I have lived in, there's almost inevitably been a cat. All the cats have been well looked after, as you would expect in a Buddhist center, and all have had access to the teachings given by very well-educated and accomplished monks. But not one of these kitties, to my knowledge, at least, has picked up even a clue to Dharma practice. And if this is so for animals that are around Dharma and its practitioners day in and day out, how much more so for those who have to live mainly with other animals in meadows and paddocks, not to mention forests or the sea in every type of weather. The imprints might still be there. One of the monks I lived with had a photo of a cow bowing down to a monk while other cows looked on. The monk who owned the photo told me that the monk in the photo had visited an abattoir where he decided to buy one of the animals due for slaughter and thus save its life. He chose one particular cow that seemed to be paying an undue amount of attention to him, and when he'd concluded the deal, the cow came up and prostrated to him. Maybe the cow could not actually practice the Dharma, but it knew about the monk and what was going on. But who knows, maybe in its own way it was practicing. Then the final of the non-human states of freedom Nagarjuna and others have spoken about is much more pleasant than the three we've just described. This is the realm of the long-lived gods. Imagine what it's like to have every luxury you can think of, where everything is always fresh and new, you stay continuously young and vibrant, you only ever smell sweet, and you only wear the best designer clothes. There's always something to entertain you. Boredom is just not an option, and you live like that for eons. You know, like some fabulously wealthy and popular film star who's found the eternal youth pill. What impetus will you have to practice the Dharma in that kind of situation? Most people would be enjoying themselves far too much. And this is the kind of situation the long-lived gods experience. And even though they temporarily have next to no suffering, they also are too involved with their pleasures to think about leading a spiritual lifestyle that will lead to their complete freedom. Sooner or later, they will continue on the wheel of life, and next time it might not be so cushy. So those are the four non-human freedoms we need to wholeheartedly follow a spiritual lifestyle. Then the four personal freedoms are again freedom from being born with wrong views, being born in a place where there are no Buddhist teachings, as a barbarian in a remote region, and stupid and dumb. In his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who was actually teaching to an audience, explains it like this. The first of these situations of no leisure is to have distorted antagonistic thinking. Those who say antagonistically that clairvoyance is impossible, or do not even see the possibility of being reborn in a situation in which the teachings of the Buddha are available, are quite incapable of pursuing the practice of the Dharma, and sometimes get desperate to the point of committing suicide. Fortunately, we're not like that. We are healthy, with a sound body and sound intelligence to understand. For example, there are some Westerners. In Tibetan, we call them yellow-haired people, but some are dark-haired, some red-haired, and some even bald. And people born in China may have no opportunity to practice the Dharma. Yet the foreigners here, although born in a country where the Dharma isn't present yet, have heard about it and its advantages, and they have come here to learn. He goes on, this is all part of the discussion of one of the situations of no leisure that the precious human rebirth is free of. Rebirth with such a body is hard to achieve, and even if reborn as a human, the possibilities of meeting the Dharma are few. Even if we've met the Dharma, if we are deficient in terms of being severely handicapped and learning disabled, the opportunity is lost. And even if we are not severely disabled, it is still possible that we were born with extremely distorted, antagonistic attitudes, and that would really hinder our possibility of developing. It is helpful if we look at each of these different situations of no leisure and think, how easily I could have been in such a situation, and how fortunate I am to be free of that. When we think very strongly we have freedom from a condition of no leisure, then we develop the great sense of happiness and relief that is a part of this meditation. Together with the eight freedoms, we also have what is known as the ten endowments. I remember them with a mnemonic that goes something like this. Human born in a central land, with faith in all faculties and no heinous actions. The Buddha has come, has taught, the teachings remain and are practiced. They are benefactors. Now basically what this means is that we've been born as a human being, in a place where the Buddha's teachings are established, and we have faith in the Dharma, and that covers three endowments. Then all our faculties are complete. In other words, we're not blind, deaf, dumb, and have good intelligence. That is the fourth. And the fifth is that we haven't committed any of the five heinous actions, which lead straight to hell realm. Those heavy actions are killing one's father, killing one's mother, or killing an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha, and causing a schism or a rift within the Sangha community. Committing any of those actions would leave such heavy karma on our mind stream that we couldn't avoid a hell existence in our very next life. As we've explained, in such a state of suffering, we would be unable to continue our spiritual journey. Those five endowments Namkapel labels the personal opportunities. The other five are his circumstantial opportunities. These are that we are born in a time when a Buddha has appeared and that he has decided to teach. When the being's minds are very degenerated, a Buddha might come to help, but wouldn't teach, because what he said would not be much benefit to the beings. A third endowment is that the teachings still remain. Of course, Buddha Shakyamuni lived over 2,500 years ago, so his physical presence can't inspire or help us today. However, his teachings are still very much in evidence and are actually followed and practiced. They would not be much good to us if they were a curiosity kept in some dusty corner of a museum or two, would they? In particular, although the Buddha died a long time ago, Buddhist monastic communities exist in many places in the world where monks and nuns practice the teachings diligently. Then the last endowment is that people still like to support serious Dharma practitioners. This means, for instance, that if I wanted to go on a long retreat in a hut in the forest, the kind people in my community would do everything they can to help me, from contributing to my food, to tramping miles into the forest, to carry that food to the hut where I'll be staying. And there we have the ten endowments, and Namkapel says it's important to think over what they mean for us. His Holiness calls them the ten enrichments, and says that although it may be difficult to meet all of them at once, it is of greater significance to appreciate the eight freedoms. That is why, he says, in various texts, they often speak of this body of great leisure, this body of respites, because these are the ones that all of us do have. The point of all this is that if we have this great opportunity, this precious human life, we cannot let it go to waste. We need to make good use of it. Namkar Pal says that having a human rebirth is praised in all the sutras and tantras as the best working basis for attaining liberation. He quotes the Indian master Ashvaghosha, who wrote, "When you have obtained a human life with a potential to go beyond cyclic existence, the most excellent potential of the awakening mind, more precious than a wish-granting jewel, what wise man would not make it fruitful?" And so there we come to the crux of the matter. The value of the precious human rebirth is to develop bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. But Namkar Pal also quotes Shantideva as a guide to the bodhisattva's way of life with these verses. "So if, when I have found such leisure as this, I do not attune myself to what is wholesome, there could be no greater deception and no greater folly. And if, having understood this, I still continue to be slothful, when the hour of death arrives, tremendous grief will rear its head. Then if my body blazes for a long time in the unbearable flames of hell, inevitably my mind will be tormented by fires of unendurable remorse. Having found by chance this beneficial state so hard to find, if now, while able to discriminate, I'm once again led into the hells, then it's as though I were mindless, like one hypnotized by a spell, not even knowing what caused my confusion or what is dwelling inside of me." His Holiness says, thinking of the importance of this precious working basis that we have, we can achieve with it all the purified states of Bodhi, namely the purified states of an Arhat, or liberated being of either Shravaka or Pratekya Buddha class, or the purified state of a Buddha. This precious human body is the basis upon which we can actually achieve any of these great spiritual goals. Outside of the precious human body, there's no other basis from which we can develop the strong bodhicitta aim. This precious human body is something absolutely essential in order to practice the tantric paths, as the great master Nagabodhi, the disciple of Nagarjuna, explains in his presentation of the stages. His Holiness then continues, "This precious human life we have on this continent is a body of actions. We live in this land of actions, which means that, based on various actions, we are able to have either a shorter life or a longer life, and we can achieve various things within this lifetime. So this precious human life is something extremely powerful. In addition to this, if our precious human life has 8 ripened good qualities, then when we think of the individual causes and nature of these 8, we will increase our capacity to achieve all our goals. To have such potential and just throw it away is a real waste, isn't it? It's as if we had a precious heirloom made of gold to use as a financial basis for supporting our lives, but instead we just wasted it. That would be a sad situation." Now, the 8 ripened qualities that His Holiness is talking about here are a long life, a pleasing physical appearance, an excellent family background, enough wealth, credible speech, power and influence, a strong physical body with great stamina, and a strong mind or willpower, and to be masculine. Now, in the shocked silence before you all start shouting about sexism, to be a male in the traditional Indian society meant you could accomplish much more than if you were a female. These days, of course, in most Western societies, females can reach the same heights in just about any field of endeavor as males, but it wasn't so in the Buddha's time. For instance, it would have been very dangerous for a woman to go into the forest to meditate alone, not only because of the threat of wild animals and so on, but also because of the robbers and brigands that haunted such places. Both males and females in New Zealand are extremely lucky to be able to isolate themselves for periods of time in the forest and expect to experience little or no harm. I expect this is also the case in places in other countries, but in ancient India, for females it was considered a no-no. So then it made sense that serious practitioners would make the wish to be born in a male body, though it's not so relevant now. A woman like Angela Merkel can withstand, I think, anything a man could. So please understand this last ripened quality without too much of a harsher mind. His Holiness continues, if this precious human body, with its 8 respites and 10 enrichments, was something easy to acquire again and again, it wouldn't be so bad. Like a child, we might think, if I don't get it today or tomorrow, I'll be able to get it soon anyway. Now, if this were so, it would be a different story. But the reality is that the precious human life is extremely rare and difficult to achieve. To understand this, we need to look first at cause and effect. If the causes are not rare, neither would be the results. But the causes themselves are very rare. The basic philosophy and outlook of Buddhism is that everything arises dependently on something else. All things come from causes. A precious human rebirth isn't something that comes about out of thin air, but as a result of causes. Living beings come from the sperm and egg of their parents, who came from the previous sperm and eggs, and so it goes, all the way back through the process of evolution. Beings developed within an environment incipient in an emerging universe that in turn came about from a previous period when such a universe was not yet existent. Going thus through cycles, advancing from even earlier cycles, all these outcomes resulted from various causes, concordant with the diverse karma of those various beings. Just as the diverse life forms in the universe came from causes, the same applies to our own individual mental continuums and the life forms that they take on. Actions that we took in the past brought about, as an effect of those actions, the births we have had. And what we do in this lifetime will determine our future rebirths. Our mental continuum doesn't always remain the same. It is different as a layperson and as a monk or a nun with vows. Monks and nuns have a special interest in devoting their entire lives to the Dharma. And what makes a monk or nun? It's the effect of the vows on their mental continuum, the various trainings, restraints, and so forth, which come from the Buddhas. This comes about through a process of causes. For instance, a monk may think, although as a monk I follow certain disciplines, if my mind becomes deluded by disturbing attitudes, I will waste this opportunity that I have. So we need to make proper use of the time and opportunities that we have. As soon as we awake in the morning, we do our various prayers and recitations. If our mind starts to wander, we bring it back. We cannot lose the opportunity, even if we need to slap our face to come back to the point of meditation. His Holiness says further that we have to guard particularly against anger. If we become angry with others, he says, as Shantideva says in Engaging in Bodhisattva Behavior, it devastates all the positive force we've built up in our mental continuum. Shantideva also tells us that the causes for anger are many, because not only do we get angry with people who irritate us, we even become impatient with birds singing loudly. We get unnecessarily upset so easily that we have to take care to be aware of this tendency towards anger. We see something inauspicious and we get upset. The dogs keep us awake at night and we get angry with them for not letting us sleep. Yet compared to the Chinese communists who are trying to justify killing, torturing and causing suffering to people, we're not so bad. At least we make an attempt to be religious, to do good things and to be on the path. And that is where we're going to have to stop today, for now time is up. Once again, thank you for joining the program today, and please tune in again next week. Please dedicate all the positive potential we've accumulated today to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.